Trevor, thanks for coming in.
No problems. Great to be here.
I've had to stop you talking because obviously you were saying some interesting stuff pre-recording. And what we were just talking about, which is normally when I research people, it's fairly straightforward. It might be hard to find the source material, but you kind of know where it is. Whereas there were so many tributaries, or whatever the term is, that went into other things, it was tough to contain. And you think that they're all connected with advertising. Obviously, I guess you've done that the longest.
They are.
But
they are.
What's the link to all these
things? I did a talk last year called Advertising is a Vehicle Which Will Fly Me to Space. Yeah. And that sums it up best, really, for me, because looking back, I would like to believe. Have you seen Nick Rogue, Man Who Fell to Earth, the Bowie film,
yeah.
The Man Who Fell to Earth? And in that story, Thomas Jerome Newton, Bowie, arrives from another planet and he spends all his energy and time and money and creativity to raise funds to build a craft to take himself back home. That's the purpose of the film and everything that that entails. And that really moved me, that film. I saw that one as a kid. It really moved me. And it's only in recent years that I've thought, bloody hell, yeah, that's what I'm doing. All I've ever wanted to do is go to space. And I've used all of these other tools at my means to raise the funds and the inclination and the spirit to go to space.
That sounds ludicrous.
It really is ludicrous, but it's also true.
For anyone to think they could go to space is just nuts. To think there may be a way.
There is that.
And then to use advertising as a vehicle to get to space. I mean, it just...
It's just true,
it sounds
though, isn't
ridiculous.
It? I'm going to space next year, and advertising has funded it.
How many people out of a million would think that it's possible to go into space?
More than you think.
Really?
Maybe four.
Four? I was going to say two. No, I don't know. It just seems... I mean, it's interesting. Obviously, you just showed me the book which will feature your school book from when you're 12. And it's kind of, I mean, I'd seen that. I can't think where I'd seen it. And it's very, quite a moving thing to have that. You can just see the sort of passion and care that has gone into that. And then to get to space next year, it's just bizarre. I can't quite think of anything like that. To have that love and focus and then for that to come true. It's like if that was a script, you would have to reject it, wouldn't you? But that's not going to happen. See, it's interesting. In coming in today, it's interesting that you'd say advertising at the heart of it, because I've been sort of reading up things and looking at different things. And to me, at the heart of all of your world, it seems, and obviously I follow you on Twitter and see lots of that, is culture. You seem to be such a... I'm sort of really into culture too. But you seem to be... that seems to hold everything together. Either doing stuff that gets into culture or buying bits of culture or just being aware of that. And interestingly, I think most people in advertising are not as obsessed with culture as they should be, because that's obviously what we... That's the goal, to get into culture. And that seems... So I was going past... because I was coming in, I was going past... BT Tower, and I thought, I wonder whether you've ever tried to get in there. That's the sort of thing I would imagine you might think, I'd love to go in that bit that revolves, because that was a big part of culture, particularly growing up.
Wow, I'm that was so almost... glad you mentioned that. I've been up there once. I went to a charity.
That's ridiculous.
It was one of the one of our Jack and Eddie Beatty Foundation launches. We were lucky enough to go there. But that building plays an important role in my family's history, weirdly.
You're joking, what?
Yeah, because my oldest brother, Kev, 60s kid, came down to London for a visit one day in the 60s and was wowed by the idea that there was this revolving restaurant at the top of the, what was called the Post Office Tower in those days. And before I even could spell London, we were told about this mythical restaurant that revolves at the top of the Post Office Tower. And why, for some terrorist-associated reason, it was shut to the public and then became owned by BT. And it would literally be the best restaurant in London, and it's not open to the public. You can get in there, but you've got to go to some BT-sponsored function to get in there. And I've always wanted to, get my brother and his wife to have lunch at that restaurant somehow. I've never achieved it. But it was such a cultural icon. The notion of a revolving restaurant,
yeah, it was
anyway.
A big thing, wasn't it?
You know, it was a thing for a while.
It was like, there's Concord, there's a restaurant that revolves.
Yeah.
It was one of a handful of things
Harrier.
That evolved. Yeah,
so supersonic planes, vertical takeoff and revolving restaurants. They've got a lot in common and they all make sense. We don't do that anymore. I, if anyone's listening, I would pay a lot of money to a charity of their choice to take my brother and his wife to lunch at the BT Tower revolving restaurant. It is part of our family.
That must be doable. It's interesting because that was a complete guess. It's like I guessed.
Yeah,
I said to Mark Denton, what's your favourite chess piece? Knowing he's a sort of idiot that would have a favourite chess piece. And, he said, it's the horse because of the way it moves and things. So that was a complete guess coming in. But it's exactly that thing of you're very into the sort of fabric of culture and what makes it work and value these things, which... interestingly, and this kind of comes up when we go through the stuff, I think people get obsessed with the ad business rather than the people you're supposed to be talking to and what's interest them, which is like the wrong way around.
Well, I think that's happened in politics as well recently.
Yeah.
More increasingly in the last year, people have been concerned with the nature of the politics, the nature of the political party rather than... The great ends to which it can be put. You know, there's a lot of navel gazing. Adland has been navel gazing for longer than a decade now.
Do you think it's got worse? I know you're sort of not as day to day on it as you once were, but
I think it's got a bit better actually in the last year. The navel gazing is less so in the last year, but it has been appalling. It has had the longest nervous breakdown in history. It's weird.
It seems like it's improving. We'll get to the sort of positive bit on advertising a bit later. But so I'm going to ask you where you grew up. And people in England might be able to figure it out from your accent, but people outside
I was born at 56 Brighton Road, Borsall Heath, Birmingham.
Right.
2,500 years ago.
2,500.
And
were you a creative kid? Were you? Well, your book looks very creative.
I used to have great handwriting. I used to draw. You know, I went to primary school and then I did the 11 plus. But I also did what's called the art exam at the age of 11, which is a weird thing. It was an art school in Birmingham. It's just been refurbished and turned into an art centre. It's 150-year-old building in Moseley Art School, it was called, Moseley School of Art. And you had to do an art exam at the age of 11, and I drew a sprig of holly and passed the art exam and therefore got a place at this grammar school, which just taught...
What's an art-based grammar school?
Yeah. Well, we did CSE and O-level. My O-levels were... art history, painting, graphic design, sculpture, and English language, English literature.
So all the creative subjects.
Exactly, yeah.
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 And
it was great.
Do you remember, so at 12, obviously, it's incredible the amount of the effect that space had on you to sort of develop that book. What other elements of culture or creativity were you taking in at the time? Was there any? Yeah. I would imagine there's nothing that competed with space.
Well, space was top, but luckily, some of my heroes were equally obsessed with space. So I got space at the same time as I got Bowie, you know, because I got two hits at Bowie, because I got Space Oddity, and that came and went, and then Moon Landing, and then Apollo, and then Ziggy. Ziggy came along and crashed into our world as kids when Bowie appeared singing Starman on Top of the Pops.
So you were aware of the Space Oddity when it came out?
Yeah,
he was on his little...
but it came and went. Space Oddity came and went.
Yeah, the one hit wonder type.
It was. Yeah. But Ziggy was here to stay. So when Ziggy arrived at school, that was when we all came in the next day and said, did you see that bloke pointing at the camera last night?
Yeah.
You know, he was pointing at me.
That's right.
Yeah, we all figured he was pointing at me, and he was pointing at us individually, you know, and it changed us forever. And so there's always been that space. I can follow that thread through. So if you go from making my space book about Apollo to seeing Bowie as Ziggy to meeting and hiring Duncan Jones, who was Zoe Bowie, to exec producing the movie Moon, to Duncan winning a BAFTA for Moon, to me then saying on that night, that's it, I'm done with advertising, I'm making movies. You can draw that line straight through, you know, from Top of the Pops to the BAFTAs.
So when you would have seen, I was slightly younger, so I didn't react to seeing Bowie on Top of the Pops in that way. What affected you about that when you saw Bowie on Top of the Pops? There was that thing where he stares down the barrel of the camera and points at you, and everybody says, oh, that was...
But you know what? It wasn't... But
what was the...
I think what was interesting was his alien persona. And it wasn't the gender sexuality thing. The sexuality wasn't there. It
wasn't known at the time.
It didn't register to us. It didn't register. We all talked about this creature being beamed down to a studio in London. We didn't question his sexuality or his gender. It was never an issue. Never even thought about it.
So what other things were you taking in at the time? Were there any ads that you kind of chanced upon or designs or things?
Since I was a kid,
culturally,
as early as I can remember, I would sing the jingles. So
which would have been what at the time?
Inane things and fantastic things. How about there are three men in my life. To one I am a mother, to the other I'm... Sorry, I'll start again. There are two men in my life. To one I am a mother, to the other I'm a wife, and I give them both the best with... Insert product here.
It's ringing a vague bell.
there was call it Wrigley's, call it Spearmint, call it gum. There was, I guess my favourite inanity was, only OXO does what only OXO can. Which is great nonsense.
Yeah.
Toblerone.
So what, you would have liked those at the time? Or
I liked them,
the
man. They were like lyrics, you see. They were lyrics, and I've always loved lyrics. So that for me... The strangeness of the jingle appealed to me in the same way the lyrics did, and I live by, anyone who's read anything I've ever written knows that it's just littered with references to lyrics. They're in there for you to discover. Yeah. You know,
certainly your Twitter feed
or nonstop.
Bowie comes up every week.
Bowie does, but a lot of different lyrics. I use lyrics to communicate how I feel, and those who recognise them get a reward because they can say, I know that song.
Feel clever.
You know.
So did that, recognising those kind of jingles and enjoying that and seeing that on a similar level to music, did that influence you to want to get into advertising? How did you get into advertising?
No, not at all, because I didn't know there was such a job. I went as far, you know, I left school, I did tragically at mathematics and... I did well at art, and so I then did a foundation course, which was an absolute waste of time because I just drank cider and fell over because everything that we were being taught at the foundation level, we already had achieved at A level.
Right.
Because there wasn't time, you know, just a little potted... So for foundation, you get a potted term on art history, which wasn't to the... degree, the extent of knowledge we were being fed for a year of it at A level. So you get a little bit of everything on foundation, whereas we already had, me and my mates already had an A level in each of those subjects, so we bust it. We went through the motions, you know.
Right.
Formed a band, you know, locked around.
So you were in a band. Weren't you at college with UB40?
I was at school with UB40.
School.
I was at school with all of them, nearly all of them. There was eight in the band, but most, you know, Brian and Ali were in my class.
Were they?
Yeah. I'm still very close to Brian now. And Earl Faulkner and Jimmy Brown, they were all there, but they all, you know, I was a SWAT and I stayed on and did my A-levels and they all, hence UB40, Unemployment Benefit Form 40, they left... in the fifth year and formed the band.
And did you think they'd amount to anything at the time? Could you see something that you did? You thought they're going to do something?
Yeah, they were great. I mean, it was the boys who got me on to reggae and soul. And again, because Bowie dictated everything I did in my life, Bowie then did Young Americans. And so I went, I have to listen to soul now because Bowie's on Young Americans. And at the same time, Brian and Ali and the boys were doing reggae. And I went, okay, now I have to get reggae and soul, out of which came funk. And that led me, you know, to Prince. So I was led, I was always influenced. I'm quite easily influenced, I think. And Bowie was making the cultural choices for me. Paul Burke wrote a beautiful thing recently about this, that how working class lads were influenced culturally through their heroes, who they introduced us, they led us by the hand and said, okay, here's Fauvism, you know, here's Bertolt Brecht, here's electronic Kraftwerk music, here's funk, here's soul, you know, here's politics. Fascinatingly we're led by our cultural icons, which doesn't happen anymore.
Doesn't happen, no.
You know?
Certainly not in music.
And they opened the doors, they opened their eyes to these new influences.
So how did you move from doing your foundation course to being in advertising?
Wolverhampton.
Right.
I went to Wolverhampton Polytechnic, did a degree there in graphic design, photography. And in the final year, final term, we did advertising. And then I finally found out there was such a job as copywriter or art director. And a guy called John Lowe, who's remains my mentor, you know, to this day, put me up for a job in London, which was a kind of scholarship. They called it a scholarship. But I dropped all my work at college, because I worked out that most of the year could draw better than me, but I could write better than them. So I figured my chances were better if I was a writer than a drawer.
And was that scholarship at Alan Brady Marsh?
Yeah.
Yeah. Which was, weirdly, that's the first ever place I went for an interview.
Do you know, I started the same day as Silla Snowball as well.
Did you?
Yeah, at that place.
And that was, I've got a memory of it being in the city somewhere.
Yeah, it was Chancery Lane.
Was it?
Yeah.
And they had a sort of very officious head of personnel who interviewed me. And I kept saying advertisement because I was trying to be posh and sound intelligent.
Brilliant.
She said, we never say advertisement. We always say ad.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it was sort of embarrassing. But that was the first time I
remained friends with Peter. Peter Marsh died a couple of years ago. But I would have an annual lunch with the blessed Peter Marsh, up until about 5 years ago.
So,
at some posh Mayfair club that they would barely let me into.
So what was he like? Because I think he's a sort of interesting. So I guess probably when you started, he may well have been the most famous guy in advertising.
Absolutely.
I think he was on Parkinson, wasn't he? He was on one of the big chat shows.
He married Elsie Tanner. He married someone off Coronation Street.
And he was very flamboyant.
And he was a funny character.
So how did you become friendly with him, given that you're on a placement and he's running the agency? There's a big gap.
I don't know. We saw eye to eye. Absolutely not politically, but in terms of how we saw advertising, really. He came along on the night that we launched B&B. He came along as like my guest of honour. Yeah, in all his finery.
So what did you must have learnt something from him then, because he was the most famous advertising guy in his day, and you most famous advertising guy in your day. That can't be a coincidence.
He said, "We used to rehearse. Can you imagine that? We used to rehearse our pitches, and we were rehearsing one day, and I was at the back of the room holding my bits of polyboard." And he sort of stopped up with his presentation and he said, fellow, pay attention. this will probably be the most exciting thing you'll ever witness in your small life. I thought, it's absolutely fantastic. There was something of the Quentin Crisp about him, you know. And it was one of the most interesting things I ever learnt in my small life. It's true. He just could trot them out. He was great. And he was hated. I guess that appealed to me as well. I kind of like villains. And he was hated. There was so many jokes going around at the time, the jokes that have been, that you can kind of index link for other people since. But
yeah.
Jokes at the time, like, he used to wear platform shoes, you know. A little fella, and he used to wear those stack shoes. And people used to say, we hear that Peter Marsh is no longer wearing platform shoes. He's having London lowered. And the other one was someone would phone in ABM and say, could you put through to Peter Marsh's office? And the PA would answer and say, I'm terribly sorry, but Peter Marsh died today. And he'd say, oh, OK, put the phone down. And then 2 minutes later, phone back again and say, can I speak to Peter Marsh, please? I'm terribly sorry, Peter Marsh died today. And this is like in the middle of his pomp, you know. And the joke is, the fellow says, oh, no, I'd just like to hear you say it. Oh. And it's just dark, and he was hated. He was hated.
Why do you think he was hated so much?
Because he was hated by...
he was successful.
No, he was successful, but he didn't do it by the rules. He was hated by the establishment of advertising. That's what it was. He didn't do it by the rules. Fascinating character.
So... obviously, there you did the Weetabix ads campaign.
Yeah.
So I found a funny little snippet, which I thought was great, which is that the initial line was a box full of little bastards.
That's correct. Yeah, that was the line. Yeah.
Which is, is great, because that's that sort of truth in advertising. Absolutely true to what it is. Obviously, I would imagine there'd be issues getting that through. Obviously,
no, but I did hone that, because it went from that to full of natural badness,
right?
Which was actually more kind of on brief, actually, but they wouldn't buy that either.
But presumably, little bastards, because they're hard and tough. Well, which I've not kind of got the link between. They're sort of skinheads. It's interesting trying to find the commercials now. They're referred to as various things. One of which is skinheads. I don't know they're skinheads, but.
They are seen as skinheads now. I never saw them as skinheads, but I guess they were. I don't know. But the reason was that at the time, 1,000 years ago, kids didn't eat Weetabix. They probably still don't now. But because it was a grown-up adult thing, you know, it's a brick of filth, you know, and there's no sugar in it, and kids were eating.
Yeah.
Sugar Puffs and Frosties. And so that became a natural enemy. Frosties and Corn Flakes and Sugar Puffs became the natural enemy of... the natural rival to this brand. And how do you make kids eat fibre? And so we were criticised for... in the press for encouraging kids to badger their parents to make them eat fibre. Which is quite weird and interesting.
You were criticised for that?
Yeah. Yeah.
So was that the first... How early into starting Alan Brady Marsh did you do that?
It's about 4 weeks or something.
Was it?
Yeah, it's really early.
Because that sounds like a very sophisticated answer now. You sort of go with the truth. You make it something. It's like an anti-hero type thing. It sounds like a very sophisticated answer.
Yeah.
And you're 4 weeks in.
Yeah. It was just common sense.
And then I also read that my only awareness of Marsh and Rod Allen is that Marsh was very flashy and flamboyant and wore white suits. Then you'd see them in their trade ads, which are bizarre. And then the other thing is that Rod Allen would have a Bontempi organ in his office
and
come up with jingles.
Weetabix wasn't a jingle. Weetabix was...
But didn't he suggest that you
of
have
course.
A jingle?
Yeah. He suggests that every single ad.
Yeah.
So he would say, what this needs, fellas, is a jingle. And he would literally turn round. I mean, you know, when back to Bowie, of course, when Bowie's in Extras with Ricky Gervais, and he kind of turns round and he's on a piano and he goes...
And he'd start doing that.
But little fat man, you know, he would literally, he'd be in his office, if you could keep him awake, he would drift off when you're reading scripts in the afternoon, he would just fall asleep. But when he wasn't asleep, he would say, "What this needs, fellas, is a jingle." And he'd turn around and go, "La la la la," and he'd play it.
How bizarre.
And so the OK, the line was, "If you know it's good for you," and the OK was Rod Allen's voice. But I found out a tip, actually, which is, if someone's falling asleep, the way to make them wake up when you're presenting to them is to stop talking.
Right, the silence wakes
them up. The silence wakes them up.
Shouting, you learned that work. Through trying to be polite to get his attention.
Trying to get Rod Allen's attention. I'll get halfway through a script and he'd drift off. And I learned that if I stopped reading it and just went, he'd say, "Oh, yes, this needs a funny jingle." And he would come alive, you know, he'd wake up.
But to be fair to him, he did some good jingles that really... So he, presumably he did I'm a Secret Lemonade Drinker.
He did Secret Lemonade Drinker. He did Age of the Toblerone Train. Out on its own, drank in a chocolate.
Really?
Yeah, he did Age of the Train. He did 1001 Cleans a Big, Big Carpet for less than half a crown. 1822.
So what an unusual creative director. Can't think of anyone else who's like that, who does their own jingles and stuff.
I don't know. I don't think that's an unusual creative director. I think all the others are the unusual creative directors.
So, and you had to present everything to him?
Yeah.
And he would sign all those up. So that become... obviously, a very big campaign. Bob Hoskins was one of the voices, wasn't he?
He was, yeah.
Did you have to go and do the voices?
Yeah. He was Bob Hoskins, I forgot.
And how many of those did you make? There seemed to be tons of them on YouTube. Yeah.
Thousands. Well, we made, me and Carl, Carl Hollis was my first art director, and he was at Wolves Polly with me, and so we got the job together. He drew the Weetabix, and we must have made 12 commercials in our first year.
Did you really?
Must have done, yeah.
Yeah. So what else did you do in that period when you were there, Alan Brady and Marsh? Did you work on, I'm trying to think what they
drank a lot.
You drank a lot. So yeah. It was a really big party and culture.
Well, I discovered wine, you said. I'd never had wine before. And it was fascinating.
In these
people kept topping
posh
you.
Posh
in these Chancery Lane, you know, wine bars. The people would top your glass up with wine. It was fascinating. Yeah, it was great.
So you didn't do much else apart from that? When you were there, which was a big thing, just looking after that alone must have been a full-time job.
Well, I was 12.
Yeah, you were very young, admittedly. So why did you leave all the wine and fun of Alan Brady Marsh?
Why did you leave ABM?
Yeah.
Oh, my God, if only I knew. We got offered a job at a place called Air Barker.
Yeah.
Hired by the remarkable Terry Howard, who... Yeah.
So again, I only know him. I think he was the chairman of Creative Circle and seemed from a distance when I started as like a sort of party, probably a big wine drinking party.
Absolutely.
Guy.
His claim to fame was Luton Airport.
Yeah.
He was a JWT man to the core. And that was that. He was the last of that generation, that, you know, that first generation of madmen, you know. Yeah. Lovely man. And we lost him a couple of years ago. Lovely man.
So was that to work? Was that the thing that made you move to work for him, or the hard cash of extra cash?
12,500 quid.
Yeah. Well, who wouldn't?
Yeah.
Move for
who wouldn't move for that? 12,500. It was the extra half that nailed it for me. Yeah. We went from something like, I think it was 10 grand to 12,500.
Yeah.
These are the big bucks. We started at ABM on 4 grand. Yeah.
Yeah. So the first, I'm going to go ad by ad. I can't think of how to avoid this. You've thrown me now. But obviously the first things I think you won awards for, it's sort of interesting in retrospect that you do this big campaign that's culturally really resonant and known, probably didn't win many awards.
Which campaign is it?
Weetabix.
No awards. No.
And then some smaller ads for Ireland, which turned up in lots of places. Is that the first stuff you'd want to watch?
I'd forgotten about that. God, yeah, you're right, I suppose so, yeah. I was quite proud of that line, actually. You'll only know by being there.
Yeah.
Because it was really relevant at the time, because people were afraid to go to Ireland.
Yeah,
because
of course,
the troubles.
That was, yeah.
It's easy to forget that now.
I didn't think that, yeah.
That's what the line was about. You'll only know it's okay, go there, it's wonderful. And we spent, my dad was Irish, so no Ireland, and
Oh, so you had some insight rather than just tackling it as a brief.
We had so much time. We would get in a car and we'd drive around Ireland for weeks on end and just bump into people and hear stories and make them into ads. That's how we did it. Yeah. So slow.
Do you think that affected, once you sort of win a few ads, you're in a new agency, you've got 12 and a half grand burning a hole in your pocket.
Oh, yeah.
At what point do you think, I might drink less and take it more seriously? At some point, you must have had a change. You've never thought that.
So far.
No, it's not kicked in yet, that change.
So far. No.
Have you not?
Have I ever taken advertising seriously? Yeah. Never in my life. You know that. When have I taken it seriously?
Well, there was a rumour. There's been lots of rumours about you going around. One of them was that when you're at TBWA...
Yeah.
So we can sort of zigzag from here.
Yeah.
So when you're at TBWA, that there was a tooth, which might not have been coming from you in retrospect, but there was a 2,000 quid a month PR budget to promote you, which at the time, I remember hearing that felt like that's someone promoting themselves. Obviously, in retrospect, when you get a bit older, that's promoting the agency.
To promote me?
Yeah. Because obviously there was a time when you you'd be in The Guardian and articles here and there'd be articles all over the place.
That's fascinating now, because journos used to ask me, journos used to say to me, you're the only ad man in town who has their own PR agent.
Yeah.
And I would say, did my PR agent phone you up about this interview? And they'd say, don't know what you mean. And I'd say, well, if I had a PR agent, wouldn't I have arranged this interview?
So is that not true then?
No, it's not true. I'm explaining it. And I would say, so did you call me?
Yeah.
Or did a PR agent organise this interview? And they say, well, I called you. And I said, well, I return people's calls. I return journo's calls. That's what I do. And could you put that in the article, please? Yeah. Could you say, given that you just asked me that question, you've heard my answer, and the truth is you called me, didn't you? Yes, I called you. Well, could you put it in the article then? And they never ever did.
So you'd heard that really rumour. Telling. So how would that, do you think that's, where has that come from? I've got no evidence. I assumed it was true.
Well, because Mark Bukowski is one of my best mates.
Yeah, that's...
But that came much later. That I knew Mark later.
So someone has
at the time. No. At the time, there was a PR budget for the agency.
Yeah.
But what that was spent on, I don't know. But what I do know is that journos
part of that in.
Well, of course, because that was my job. But it wasn't to promote me.
But I think I think that you were on the. I think a bit like Peter Marsh in a sense that I can remember when you were skipping right ahead, busting my whole timeline. But so when you got the job as creative director of Homes Night Richie.
Of Homes Night Richie?
Yeah, weren't you? Or TBWA, wasn't it? Homes Night Richie? I think it was Homes Night Richie. looking at me, you're throwing me now because you're looking puzzled. But
no, because you know so much more about my career than I do. So
let me tell you then. You were promoted, and I know this is true because David Holmes told me. So you went to Homes Night Richie.
Yeah, but I didn't go there as creative director. No,
but you were promoted to creative director at Homes Night Richie. Because David David Holmes about this.
Yeah.
And so when you were, there was lots of people who were furious about that. You know, in the sort of...
Were they?
Of course, yeah.
Well, in the agency or in the business?
No, in the sort of, you know...
Business?
Yeah.
Why?
Because you could... So I think unfairly, but I probably would have been one of the people that would be.
Why?
Because
what's the crime that there I was committed?
The crime that you committed is A, you were very young, B, you hadn't gone through the normal, what was considered the normal routes of Abbott Mead, BBH, blah blah blah, and then C, you're supposed to have X amount
of pencils
and this thing and that thing. So when you look at that now. Obviously, whose business is that to have a view on what someone else is doing? Yeah, it seems bizarre now, but I think that it's easy to forget how sheep like everybody was. Yeah. That you go it here, was very intense, you gradually yeah. work your way step yeah. by step, and you get yeah. to a better one, and you might get another head in the yeah. book, and blah, blah, blah. So then all of a sudden, you sort of crash in from left field, and your creative director at the time, and creative director was CCO or whatever the, you know, title creep is now. That was the main job.
Yeah.
So of your contemporaries, of the people I know, would be furious at that. Because it's like, how did that happen? That's not... Did you not get any not sense of that? So no, I think that really. That... my guess would be that sort of rolled on into however many years later. Now he's got a PR guy, which essentially, in retrospect, is just a lot of jealous people.
Yeah.
So he seems to have jumped the queue. Now he's... in all the bloody papers and on TV.
But if you've got a PR guy, you've still got have something to say.
Yeah, you've still they don't come back unless you say anything interesting.
You know, they don't just write... If you haven't got anything to show or anything to say, then what's the article about?
No.
I don't quite understand the points.
What I'm saying is, I think, in retrospect, you're on the... You're... through jealousy... on the wrong side of a lot of envy that goes from
right.
getting that job, I would say, from where I sit, getting that job then to being in getting loads of PR.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of people who feel jealous, and I wonder whether, because I've heard that story.
Well, I never lost any sleep.
No, but as you shouldn't. You obviously you didn't do anything wrong. I'm only saying it in retrospect. I find it sort of interesting.
It's quite quaint.
And obviously, even if Mark Bukowski is given the TBWA job of PR in the agency, the first person he's going to talk to is you because you're in charge of the output. And if you talk to The Guardian and you do well, they'll come back. So I don't know why, in retrospect, that was separated out as a rumour that went round.
I think about that rumour, but I think that the objection that I understood was that people would say to me, why are you talking to journos about your work? Isn't your work good enough to sell itself? That's the kind of knockback I got. And people saying, you don't need to talk about it. You're kind of admitting your work's not good enough by having to flog it through the media.
Yeah.
Well, it's an interesting argument, but that's the argument that's put to me. Your work isn't good enough to sell itself, so you have to be up there selling it. Until clients started saying to their creative directors, why aren't you on Radio 4 talking about my brand today? When this oik was on and mentioned it 20 times today, mentioned his brand 20 times today, and everyone's talking about that advert, you know. That's literally your job. It's literally your job.
Of course.
So I find it old-fashioned and quaint and amusing, really. I don't know whether that still exists.
So did you not get any... Because it's interesting... Did you not get any sense that of that sort of, if there was that rumour going round or that sort of, I don't know what you'd call it, but jealousy is the sort of most accurate thing I can think.
But I was never part of the establishment, I'm still not. And so, you know, I didn't feel the need to belong to that club. And I never felt...
Which, again, probably makes it worse for those people. Do you know what I mean?
Because I didn't lose any sleep on it. And I didn't think, God, I've got to impress these guys. Because if I don't... What? I don't really care. I don't care what... I never cared what people who worked in advertising thought about me. I still don't.
So, going back a bit. So, when David Holmes... So, I remember talking to... I can't remember now. Unfortunately, because I do these podcasts, I can never remember whether this was something someone said to me during the podcast or separately. Mm. But I remember David Holmes being so excited to say, and then, like, I can't remember how he put it, but it was almost like I found Trevor and he was the answer, and then he sort of promoted you to that position.
He was such a lovely man, David.
He was great. I only knew him towards the end of his life. Yeah.
Did he tell you about the day that they fired him?
Yeah, when he marched
the
around.
With the bagpipes. I was on a shoot that day, and I didn't know, no one knew he was going to do it. I was on a shoot, probably in Bloody Island, and someone phoned me up and said, you've got to bloody listen to this. And I could just hear the bagpipes going on.
He was doing it. Where was he, Primrose Hill or someone? He did it. And in the agency.
In the agency. He got a piper in the agency to parade around. And I could hear it on the end of the phone. It was, I love that kind of stuff. It's great. It's theatre.
How did you cope with overseeing people when all of a sudden you've got to oversee people, presumably older than you?
But it wasn't all of a sudden, you see. It wasn't. I felt that I'd been acting as creative director for quite a while, so I was already because I was bringing on young teams and approving work and looking after people anyway. So it wasn't kind of, it might have been an out of the blue appalling decision from the rest of the business, but the industry, but it was completely straightforward move as far as the agency's culture was concerned. It's no big deal.
So how did you deal with the people? Did you just take to that naturally? Because I know at TBWA, I got the sense that you would entrust them with, a bit like David Abbott, you would entrust them with back there, and Tony Cox, funny enough, there would sort of be, if I hire you and I get you to do that, I'm pretty much, you don't have to come to me for every
It's the only way you can do it.
Yeah.
Well, it's the best way.
Well, was that an instinctive thing, or had you seen someone do that?
Yeah, because no one goes to creative director school. Oh, did I see someone do it? That's a really good point. Look, I only really had one creative director in my life, and that was Terry Howard. It was the only one.
Right.
You know, I was creative director at 29, so I never had a creative director in the old school sense. You know, you had crazy Rodden. That doesn't count.
Yeah.
And then I had, you know, equally crazy Terry Howard. I remember I took... I took a script into Terry once. This is the best example I can give of how I was taught to be a creative director. One incident alone, the only example I can give. I took a script in, and it was for Licorice All Sorts. And I took it in to Terry, and I showed him the script, read him the script, acted it out, and he went... And he was very Keith Richards. He was really like Keith Richards in his manner. You know?
Really?
Really like him, taught like him, knew him, all of that, you know. And he'd sort of, oh, it's okay, man, it's okay. And I'd say, no, Terry, it's not. This is the best thing I've ever written. This is great. It's going to be great. And he went, that's all right. It's all right, man, but it needs a fucking end line. And I went, no, it doesn't. It doesn't need an end line. And the story was that Licorice All Sorts are Moorish, and if you eat enough of them, you will turn into Bertie Bassett, right? Yeah. And it came from a phrase that my mum used to say, which was, if you eat too many, eat another one of them chips, you'll turn into a chip. So that's where it came from.
Yeah.
And I had this lovely script where that happened, and Terry went, it's all right, man, but it's not great. It needs an end line. And I scowled off back to my office and sat there and snarled and went, oh, what does he know? He knows nothing. And then that weekend I wrote One Too Many and He Might Turn Bertie. Yeah. And I took it back into him on Monday morning and went, I've done this. And he went, now it'll win in Cannes.
Right.
And it won in Cannes.
Really?
And that moment, I'm missing an important point. He said to me, I can't write it for you. And I don't fucking care if you don't write it, but it needs an end line.
And is that what? That's how you would creative direct.
And that's what I learned. That's what I learned. That when you're dealing with Paul Silburn and Mr. Belford, Nigel and Paul, you know, that they're better than you. It's the first thing you learn. And you've got
hard
to back
to do,
them.
Harder than
you've got to back them, and you've got to. Your job is not to tell them how to do stuff. Your job is to defend them, and defend what they do, and trumpet it, and persuade others that what they have done is right. So I would take the work from them and say, leave this to me. Your job is to write it. My job is what happens next. And I would take it over here and convince a whole range of people that this is the right thing. That's my job. That was my job. And Terry saying, well, I can't write it. And also, don't give a shit if you don't. You're lost.
Yeah.
Was that, it's that kind of parental psychology in a way. It's
that, so there's not many people who do that. You know, I'm trying to think.
I wouldn't know because I don't know any creative directors.
No. Well, I mean, instantly, I think... So, for example, I work for Tim Delaney, who would be...
Well, that's the polar opposite.
...crossing out words and, you know, which was fine. It wasn't, you know, it was a different, very different way. But the people who spring to mind would be Tony Cox, David Abbott. It's a good gang. Tony Cox, David Abbott, Colin Millwood, who would be... But I think it's very hard to not... I find it hard to not ever get involved and say it's not right, go away. I mean, I think, for example, Colin Millwood would sometimes say, no, do it again. So he wouldn't discuss any issues. Wouldn't say, it's not, you know, sometimes it needs an end line or whatever. And the people who worked for him...
You can't just say, go away and do another thing. That's no guidance at all.
That's what I would think. But the people who worked for him would appreciate that because they'd have to rethink the whole... I mean, I couldn't do that because that would seem unfair to me to say, it's not that, it's something else. And then off you go. But the people who came up to him... they would go away clueless as to what the answer was, so they'd have to rethink the whole thing, and they would say that ultimately that was really beneficial. I couldn't do it, and I can't see how it would be beneficial than to point out where there may be an issue.
But there's the other issue, which is that a team, some teams and some people are useless at identifying which of the four ideas they've created is great.
Yeah.
That drives you mad. Because you look at it and you say to yourself... there's glaringly three piles of shit there and one golden piece. And you're sometimes tempted to go, you do know you've got a winner there, don't you? You just don't know which one it is. You do know in those four there's a winner, you know. And there's that. And then there's the, you'll write a line to help them. They'll take it away and then they get all of the glory for it's theirs. Yeah. And that's the way it should be. It's theirs. But often it's your job to tell them to recognise the thing that they've done and why it's right. Because a lot of them don't get it. They don't know that they've created something special. But it's your job to hand for the gold, you know.
So as someone who's obsessed with culture, so you must have been delighted to go to P&P with Webster. Would he have been your person you would have liked to have emulated or...
Yeah, and I was disappointed.
Your main person.
Yeah, and I was disappointed.
So how long were you there? So you got merged 12 in...
12 minutes.
Was it 12 minutes?
Yeah, we merged, Davies and Pierce merged. And
would he have been your main... Obviously, there would have been all that... You must have sung loads of these jingles, for example.
No, I've got to stop you. No, because I don't have... None of my heroes work in advertising. So I know people like to hero worship, you know, their peers, but I really don't.
And you didn't then?
No, I thought he was good, but I don't think he's God.
But at the time, did you... the other...
I didn't have
that
this.
You're doing now.
I
presumably,
didn't
you didn't have those.
You know, fawning admiration for him. I thought he was all right.
Yeah.
But he was past his best by the time I knew him. He was, you know.
Yeah.
He was, you know, he couldn't fight 12 rounds anymore. You know, he
So what year was that when you went there?
I don't know.
1991, I think it was something like that.
I don't know years of anything. Yeah. But no, it was not a very pleasant time. You know, we were merged in.
Yeah.
And there was a genuine animosity. Between the, again, it's this kind of cult of the pure bloodline of BNP and these infiltrators. The Herberts had come in from Davidson Pierce. And it was a them and us situation. You know, we heard people in the corridors say, oh shit, bad news, we've just heard that they've won New Zealand Lamb. I heard that one day. They've won. So, the Davidson Pierce people had pitched for a £10 million account and won it for the agency. That's bad news.
That was bad news.
Because
really
they've won it. And that's just deeply unpleasant, you know. That's all that bollocks. So it was unpleasant. I didn't like it.
That still lingered on for a long time. Yeah. So they, when I interviewed Mark Reddy, they, at the time, Mark was, I don't know if he was there when you
were
there.
Yeah, he was. Well, Mark was Davidson Pierce, was he?
No.
Oh, I don't know.
He was at Homes Like Richie.
Homes Like Richie, yeah. That was it.
So he... because he was quite ornate and detailed, they would call him, the people we probably all think of when you say the people with the bloodline, would all call him the doily designer, in like a really sort of mean-spirited, that he wasn't quite part of the game.
I found it an unpleasant place to be. Didn't like it at all.
And did you deal with Webster or Frank Budgen or any of those people who you would...
No, Frank had gone then.
Had he?
I think Frank had gone. Webster was right at the tail end, but he didn't deign to speak to people.
Did he not?
Not really. Not really.
And then there's that story, which is about when you went, that I've heard. It's funny, all these rumours.
When I went where?
When you were fired.
Yeah.
So there's almost the worst firing story I've ever heard involves you, the rumour. Okay. If it's right. Do you know that?
Well, I know what happened. I was there. But you tell me the story and I'll tell you if it's true.
Yeah, I don't know whether it's true, which is that someone comes in. Have you not heard this? Someone comes in and they say...
His name was David.
Right. And he says, you should tell this if this is true.
Yeah, so I'll tell you what happened. Yeah, you tell me if it lines up with what you've heard, but I'll tell you what happened. Me and my art director, Carl, were there. And as I said, it had been deeply unpleasant for the whole time we were there. And then a rumour spread that they were going to lay off something like 25 people on Friday, including senior creative directors and teams. And we didn't want to believe it. And we got called in by this fella called David. And we were about to go on a shoot, me and Carl, to India for Bachelors. And he had two brown envelopes. And he said, got some bad news for you, fellas. You've fallen on the wrong side of the line. It's the exact phrase he used. You've fallen on the wrong side of the line, and I'm afraid we're going to have to let you go. And I said, but we've got work to do. We're going on a shoot to India next week. And he went, we're well aware of what you're doing. And I said, our work is on the reel, on the television in reception. You don't even know who I am, mate. You don't know who I am. We've got work. I was quite indignant rather than upset. I was quite indignant about it. And I said, our work's on reception. It must be mistaken identity here, you know. And he said, we're well aware of who you are.
Yeah.
And he shuffled around a bit and he had two envelopes and he went, which one's Trevor?
Yeah. Which is unbelievable.
And I vowed from that fucking day on that he would know which one was Trevor.
Yeah.
You know, and that's actually what happened. He said, which one's Trevor?
How did you take that? Because
really badly. Really badly. I went to Birmingham. I went to Test Match. We were mates from school, you know, and I was a mess. And
because it seemed so unfair.
Because the dream was over. Because I'd gone to London to make it and I'd failed. And so I went to the match with the lads and I told them it was over and I said, I'm going to have to come back to Brum because I've tried and I've failed. And they gave me the biggest bollocking of my life. It was great. I still know those lads. And my mate Kev just took me aside, you know, and said, you're doing it for us. You're going back to London. We're not having you back here. We don't want you back. Your job is to be in London. He said, I dine out on your stories. You ain't coming back here.
Right.
And they spent a day bollocking me, saying, it's your job to go down there and do it, you know.
So what shook you so much about that then? Because you thought, well, it's the best agency I've got to where I want to be.
No. It's not to do with agency brands. It was my love of my job. You know, my love of my job. I loved what I did. I gave everything to that job, not to that agency, maybe not even to that clique of an industry, but I loved making adverts. Simple as that. I loved making adverts. And it was my every waking hour. I just wanted to make adverts that people talked about. It's all I wanted to do, right? So to get turfed out broke my heart. And I would sit at home and I'd watch the adverts on telly and they were all shit.
Yeah.
And that just made me even angrier. And I vowed that if I ever got a job, an office, you used to have offices in them days, if I ever got an office, that I would sit there on a Sunday afternoon and write adverts because I could. And when I got back in the business, I used to do that a lot. I would go in on a random Sunday afternoon. When I was fucking chairman of TPWA, I would go in on a Sunday afternoon because I had an office and a job. It damaged me that much. I would go in and sit there and go, I can do this. And it was on one of those Sunday afternoon sessions that Double Life was born, because that's when the guys came in with the script for Double Life on the Sunday, yeah.
So in retrospect, that was probably a good thing that happened.
No, it wasn't a good thing.
Was it not?
It was professionally the worst thing that ever happened to me.
But it sounds like that, as you say, I kind of vowed that he would then know which one was Trevor, which I'm sure he does. So it must have...
Still not a good thing.
It's never good being fired, but the Mark Denton, or what's his phrase, is the burr under your saddle, or whatever the thing is, that sometimes, you know, you need those irritating things to push you on.
But what happened to Mark and Chris was utterly disgraceful. And my quirky little redundancy bears no relation to what happened to those guys. That was a living disgrace. But that's another story. And those two are much nicer people than me, and they bear no grudge, and they carried it all these years, and they just put up with it, and they brush it aside as if it was a little incident, and it was appalling. I was laid off. No big deal. I was just laid off. What happened to them was different.
But why would you not say that was... I was fired from my first two jobs. And I think that... that made me, in my next job, really want to get out as much work as possible. Because to think, next time I'm in somewhere, I just want to work on every brief, so that if they fire me, I come away with tons of work.
Yeah.
And I still feel like that now, all these years later, which you could say is a bad or good thing.
But also you would have had to have laid people off as well.
Yeah.
You know, and so it does make you fully aware that there's no good way of doing it either. I've never... You know,
quick is the only.
I've had to lay people off, and I've always been amazed at how well people take it.
Yeah.
Because I didn't take it well, and so if I'd had to lay people off, I wouldn't sleep the night before, probably two nights before, and I'd be a mess talking to them. And yet, 100% of the people that happened to. Took it really well, amazingly, strongly, you know. But I guess when...
Because of what you'd done previously. So they factor that into how you've been with them previously.
I guess when it happened back in, 1757 at BNP, it didn't happen then. It was a rare thing, And to lay off kind of 30 people in a day doesn't even get reported anymore, but it was headline news. It was front page story. But guess what? They laid off all the James and Pierce people. Might have been a coincidence.
But if this was the film, which we'll get to later, but if this was the film, the second film, not the one about going to space, that would be the moment where you go, right, I'm going to, almost what you've said, I'm going to show those guys that they're wrong, they behave badly, and you're going to know who Trevor is in the film. Then you go...
Terrible film.
Yeah, I don't know, maybe that's you know, a couple of years when you've got your space thing out your system. But... that's the point where you go, and then that's why, watch what happened afterwards. That's that moment, isn't it, in the film, where you go, that was energy and desire to go and watch this. And bit by bit from there, you get better and better known and win more and more awards and do stuff from that moment. If you took that out, would you be drinking wine at BNP, doing a bit here and there? Does that?
Probably.
Don't know.
Probably. It wasn't a nice place.
No, it's.
And it's fascinating what's happened to it now. You know, I think it deservedly won Agency of the Decade. I think Adam and Eve are deservedly Agency of the Decade. It's for the rest of the industry now to do something about that. You know, but maybe it's a better place now. Maybe it's a nicer place to work at.
How did you get back from that? Your friends saying you're not coming back to
Birmingham? I wasn't allowed back to Brum. It was simple as that, because they were living vicariously through me. And so I had that responsibility. And my dad never saw me make it in London. So my dad had sent me to London to make it. So that was a kind of fatwa. I had to make it. So it was stacked emotionally, you know.
So how did you go about...
I wasn't allowed to fail.
Rebuilding.
Wasn't allowed to fail. I can't remember. I can't.
Your next job was TBWA. I think it was.
No, it was Holmes Knight Ritchie. We were jumping around.
After that, sorry.
Holmes Knight Ritchie became...
That's right.
You see, in those days, agencies merged every 3 weeks. So there was a point where over 2 years, I think we had 12 mergers. That is why if we accelerate this a bit forward, that is why TBWA London was the fantastic agency that it was, because it was a merger of about five different shops, all of whom brought their super talented people and their beautiful accounts. Most agencies have two accounts in which they can do great stuff. But if you put five of them together, now you've got 10, you know, plus all their fabulous people, you can't fail. And it didn't fail. We had a fantastic time.
So I can remember, which comes into this sort of cultural thing. We had lunch about a job once in Heels. And you brought along a sheet of paper with logos on. So it's a very unusual perspective and shows where you're coming from, which was, look at those logos. And obviously, cut to 10 years later, me and Paul came in.
Client logos, you mean?
Client logos.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's an unusual view, obviously, because you can see in those the sort of cultural resonance of those icons.
Yeah.
But that's not how anyone else has ever spoken about jobs, clients, potential. Because a bit like when we're talking about the BT Tower, Post Office Tower, there's something in those that you can see, that cultural relevance, I think. And then about 10 years later, me and Paul come in and did a bit freelance for you when we were both at Loose End. And your reception was essentially that piece of paper blown up when you walk in. Square boards, logo, famous logos all over the wall. And I suppose, you know, when I was thinking about talking earlier on, it's trying to sort of, I think you do come at it slightly in a different place, which is much more culture-based. And I wonder how that affects what you do when you sit down to create an idea. How do you...
Absolutely.
When we're talking about that period, when we, certainly in the 80s, there was a very, in retrospect, a very formulaic way of doing ads. And I think, having got together a ton of your stuff over the last few days, it's a much more eclectic, playful bunch. So there's like, you could group it, there's like a period in the sort of early 90s where there's lots of wordplay, like environmental. Oh, this has gone blank now, but there was like a few of them in the set. It's like you went through that phase.
Well, there's Toys R Us.
Toys R Us. And a few of them. But they're all, proper posters, which is barely any words,
and
which
Beckham, people don't do. Was Adidas, Beckham, Cometh the Hour. And,
Cometh the Hour.
Yeah, things like that.
But so that's a really good example. The Beckham one is to me, it's almost, that's come from culture into advertising rather than advertising out.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean?
Yes,
that's the sort of perfect, how do we want to affect culture? What's the right thing to say? It's like your tweets, which I think are really good, which is, what's the right thing to say rather than what does a brief say, if you know what I mean? So I would imagine that you're not a stickler for sticking to the brief. I'm going to guess. I don't know.
Depends
what the brief is.
No, it depends on the brief. I think you've got to have a good brief. I do like a good brief. It's about interpretation. But I think brief's important. I would never throw a brief away.
So let's take FC UK. Mm-hmm. Which is obviously a fantastic. How long did that run? 10 years?
Too long. I tried to stop it five times and walked away from it in the end.
Did you?
Because I wouldn't stop it. It was diminishing returns. Anyway.
But that's...
It ran for a long time, yeah.
But again, I would say that's another example where that's someone who's interested in culture spotting something rather than an advertising idea.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? Spotting the power of that. So I think was it on a fax or something you saw it? Which I think most people wouldn't. Might see it, might think that looks like a rude word, but they wouldn't go with it.
But it can only be for that company.
It could only. It
can only be for that company, and then that's the important thing about it. You know, you can only talk about FCK by naming the company, and that's all I care about. You know, that was criticised as much by the industry as it was by the Daily Mail, interestingly, because people in the industry didn't see it as a creative idea. They thought it was some weird gimmick, you know, shortcut to an idea.
But that's exactly the sort of point, which is...
didn't win any awards, you know.
Did it not?
Well, not just didn't win any pencils, you know.
But that's a sort of cultural idea. It's not the little neat things that people do in advertising.
Mm.
So I can remember a slightly similar thing, but on a way much smaller scale, doing a doodle of Merry Down thing. That's weird. That's like Merry is like happy and Down is sad.
And so you get the upside down face. Yeah, yeah. Beautiful.
Thinking, beautiful. That's quite neat. And then put it to one side, because I think it's not really an idea. You know, it's not an idea, is it? It's just a little observation. And then eventually sort of came back to it. But obviously I've got too much of what you should do and what ideas should be that I dismissed it. Eventually you sort of came back to it. But I imagine it's a similar sort of thing, although you probably may not have dismissed it, like me. But obviously the power of that when you put it into culture is much bigger than, you know, these sort of formulaic ideas with payoffs at the end that were much more popular at the time, you know.
It was like riding a bucking bronco, you know. It was holding on as it went mad, you know. And it also, the main thing about FC is that it brought in so much new business
because it was so
because
famous.
Of the attitude, yeah, the attitude of it, in the way that I suppose that, you know, in another extreme, John Lewis has brought in so much business because people like what they see, clients like what they see, and of its time, you know, that was the right vibe for its time, and so clients were saying, I want some of that. I don't want a misspelled swear word, but I want some of that attitude.
Do you think you could run that now?
No, I think it would last 5 minutes because of Twitter, because of social media.
Would pull it down.
It would just be, it would be viscerated within a few hours. It's not a big enough... It's not a robust enough thing for our times now, I don't think. But I think that about all ads. I think that ads are mortal creatures. You know, they're not immortal. No. They belong in their time, and they should be viewed within the context of their time. You know, and we don't do that in Adland. We take them out and we put it in a box and we go, look at that. And it means nothing if you take it out of its culture.
No.
You know, it's born of its culture.
I was looking at the... Wonder Bra stuff today, thinking, I wonder whether you could run that now. It's the sort of perfect thing for that loaded era.
It is, but it's now post. It would be post, ironically. I don't know. Those things are of its time.
I think there's too much emphasis put on. Obviously, if it's brilliant in its time and it's not now, then that's perfect because it's not supposed to. It's not designed for now.
It's supposed
exactly
to be
that. Powerful.
Which
then.
Is why you can put a, you know, which is why you can put a, an illustration of a toucan with a pint of Guinness on its beak as a poster in a bar, but it's not an ad.
Yeah.
Because it was done 100 years ago. Why doesn't it now sell stuff? Because it's just a piece of art, and that's it. Things are of their time. All ads are of their time. I believe. In fact, if they're not, then they're not doing their job. They should either reflect or influence or create the culture around them. They belong. You can't uproot them, you know, and expect them to still make sense. They shouldn't make sense. I don't think.
So I've got, like a DJ, I've got a perfect thing of things not making sense. I went through the PlayStation ads. They're some of the weirdest ads I've ever seen.
I'm so proud.
And the
David Lynch.
Lynch.
Well, Chris Cunningham and David Lynch. And two of the proudest moments of my career. Yeah. You know. Well, in the space of 3 years, working with Hugh Hudson, Nelson Mandela on UNICEF, and then the next year David Lynch and PlayStation, the next year Chris Cunningham and PlayStation. You don't get years like that.
So interestingly, the Chris Cunningham one still looks incredibly. You could run that tomorrow. It's incredibly contemporary feeling. I don't know if that's because it's not overly CGI'd or I don't know how he exactly what he did.
Shot it on a camcorder.
And was that always the plan?
Mm, yeah. The plan was an alien creature had been captured and locked in a cellar and she was going to deliver a kind of particle broadcast. That was just the idea. And I wrote that poem. And all we had... I worked with Fink on some of that as well, actually, on some of the poster work for that. Land on your own moon, because you know a lot of the phrasing from that poem lent itself to posters. You know, land on your own moon in particular. But again, it was space. It was the influence of space, and And all I had was that poem and a piece of paper and Chris Cunningham's crap cartoon of Fifi. And that was our pre-production meeting. That was it. No storyboard, no.
So no deck of different directors giving their views on what it should be. And what about the David Lynch one? Because
David Lynch was similar. With David Lynch, I had a notion of the third place, that which has come true now because it was not work and not home. It's another place. Well, that place has now been filled by social media. It's called social media now, and at the time it was a new thing that place actually wanted to inhabit. And so I wanted it to be a road movie. And we, through contacts, I got to David Lynch. We sat down at David Lynch's house and I talked him through it. I could talk for hours about this ad alone, and he said, I love it. It's a road movie. And I said, yeah, it's a road movie. And he said, we'll shoot it in my house. And I went, oh, God, how are we going to shoot a road movie in your house, David? That'll be fine. It'll be fine. We'll shoot it in my house. And he shot a road movie indoors, and David Paton, the best client in the world, just ran with it, and just said, yeah, let him run. You can't hire David Lynch and tell him how to direct. So when David Lynch says there's going to be a bloke with a mallard duck's head, then there is,
And was that pre, what's it called, Double Life?
Double Life. I think that was after Double Life.
Was it?
I think so. Yes, because that's PlayStation 2. PlayStation 2, the third place.
Yeah.
Double Life came before that, I think. But that was the genius of Frank, My God.
So, and was that the first time you'd worked with Frank? I know you wrote a nice piece on Frank. I did that thing on him.
Yeah, and then I worked with him on Pretty Polly a lot and a few other things. Loveliest man. But to be able to work with Frank and with David Lynch and with Chris Cunningham, it's just a dream,
So in that period, we could mention a couple of people, you seemed to go on a hiring spree. Some of them you may have inherited when the agencies merged, but one of them that you hired was Paul Silbern. Our friend, who sadly we were at his funeral the other day. How did you manage to lure Paul away from nobody had been at the time?
He was, at the time, I think he was Leith London, which was going nowhere. And I met up with him in Cannes, which for a pair of working class oiks was a peculiar, peculiar thing. But he used to like sitting on the terrace at the Carlton, I think.
Yeah.
And we sat on the terrace at the Carlton. Sipping our cheeky glass of rosé, and it seemed so funny looking back. And I offered him the job, and he said, "Can I think about it?" And he thought about it for a year, and he took it. And
he thought about it for a year. Did you just say?
Kind of, yeah. He didn't take it straight away. He said, "I'm going to try and make Leith work." And then it was months later when he said, "Okay, I'll do it. Let's do it. Come over." And when he went to America, when you lose someone like that, you kind of can get racked with regrets. And one of my regrets with Paul was that I couldn't tell him that I was doing B&B, and if he hadn't gone to America, he would have inherited TBWA. You see, he would have taken over after me, and he left. And I really regret that because he didn't enjoy America. Yeah. I'd much rather he'd have taken on that mantle. He'd have been brilliant as great director of TWA.
And he was your deputy, wasn't he, though?
But he was, I gave him free reign.
So how did you work with him?
Accounts. My promise to him was that he's got his own agency. He can go there. He approves his own work. I've got his back. So I'll sell his stuff. I'll promote his work. But I'm not his boss. How can you be Paul Silbern's boss? So you let him do it. And he was brilliant with the young teams. He really brought them on. He really looked after them. But he was fiercely competitive. And he was a brilliant gossip. Brilliant gossip. He was gossip for England. He was great. And he went off to America. And I wish he hadn't gone to America. And he didn't enjoy it. And he phoned me one day from the snowy wastelands of, what was it?
Minnesota.
Minneapolis.
Yeah.
And it's funny because as I said, I don't have heroes who work in advertising. It doesn't make sense to me that some bloke who works in advertising should be a hero. Is nonsense. But to Paul, that was different. So for Paul to get offered a job by the blessed Pat Fallon was very special to him, meant nothing to me, really special to him. Now, me going and meeting Prince in Minneapolis, that's a different gig. That's a different thing. Then I am
did
in
you
awe.
Meet Prince in Minneapolis?
I did meet Prince. Not in Minneapolis, in Wembley, but I did meet Prince. But Paul meeting Pat Fallon was an amazing thing for him. I don't give a toss. But Pat Fallon publicly firing Paul was a disgrace. He didn't have to do that. It's a disgrace. And Pat Fallon made a point of saying it publicly to cover his own sins, and it's unforgivable. I don't... You know, deeply unpleasant. That ended deeply unpleasantly. You know?
Obviously, Paul did all the John Smiths, which was amazing. And there was a tweet went out the other day from Dave Trott saying he's only seen two ads that have stopped a pub, I think he said. And one of those was John Smith's. I can't remember the exact execution. But so it seemed like you had a group of people that Paul was very... I don't know if populist is the right word, but these things that would be popular. This is populist. And then you've got your PlayStation, which is a completely... It feels like there's lots of flavours.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? Mm. It wasn't, you know, at the time agencies would be...
That's right. We boasted about
it. It felt
that.
Like you had very different exactly flavours within the department.
Exactly that. The agency...
And that was a conscious thing.
It's very important to the agency, and I'd like to think TBWI still has that. It doesn't have a tone of voice, because the tone of voice should be the client, to the product.
Yeah.
And to the person you're speaking to. So you don't just want a yard of BBH, a yard of TBWA. You know, it shouldn't work like that. They should all be different. And I do feel that agencies fall into that trap of, here's our showreel, and all the ads have the same tone of voice. It's wrong, I think, because products are different. So why would everyone want the same tone of voice of them?
Well, presumably that partly comes about, and I don't know how you managed it, when you do FC UK, and people come to you and say, can you do that for us?
Yeah, and I used to say to them, I would say to them, what do you want? Do you want a misspelt swear word? Do you want to get into trouble with the press? Do you want your sales to quadruple? Do you want to be talked about in the pub? You know, it means, when someone asks for an FC UK, it means a lot of different things. That's how I would answer that, you know. We didn't have a tone of voice at 2BW, and we prided ourselves on that.
So why did you... I'm trying to think of what that... Do you remember that Dave Stewart came up with this theory that was a particular syndrome where everything's going too well? Do you remember this?
No.
He had a name for it. I can't remember what it is. But it seems like that was the place you got to where you got as much business as you can handle, you're winning loads of awards...
Mm.
You've got good people all around you, so you think, right, let's leave. Start my... What made you want to... What made you leave?
Pretty much what you said. Yeah, really.
All just felt too...
I wanted. I'm a cricket fan, and I wanted to stand at the wicket with naught against my name again. And see what happened. That's what it was.
And did you have a plan, a philosophy, anything, or just think,
give it a shot. My family hated me for it.
For doing that?
Yeah, they thought it was a ridiculous thing to do. For a year, they must have thought that.
Well, you did it for a year. Right. Well, you did
I'm exaggerating. No, they just thought it was such a weird thing to do, to walk away from what looked like a job for life, you know. Great director and chairman and all of this money and stuff and happiness. Why would you walk away? Because.
Yeah.
Because, you know. But, yeah, we got a great momentum going. We won our first six pitches and we were off to the races.
You won your first six pitches?
Yeah, we were off to the races, yeah.
And what was that? What would that be? McCain's?
No, not McCain. Because
was that not in your...
No, because we
pitches?
Weren't allowed to pitch for McCain for a year legally. And that was a good thing because it meant that we couldn't just leave and set up with an account. That was a good thing. So we had to come back and pitch for McCain against 2WA and JWT, I think it was. So, no, we won things like Carling and First Choice and Tui and HP and a bit of Heinz and Westfield, all sorts of things. But the point being that those accounts were... The luck of it all is those accounts were available to pitch for.
Yeah.
You know, if they weren't available to pitch, we wouldn't have won anything. And right now, well, in recent years, there just hasn't been that kind of churn because all the accounts are at Adam and Eve and they don't leave. So in those days when all the accounts weren't at Adam and Eve, they used to churn around a lot. And I think one of the achievements of Adam and Eve is they've held on to those accounts.
Yeah.
You know, they've bedded them in and they held on to them. Yeah. And that's changed the nature of the business. Things aren't moving around with the pace they used to. So when we started B&B, stuff was moving and we were able to dive into that pool and, you know,
you've still got to win it.
Go for it. You've still got to win it. Well, but you've got to have the chances.
It seemed like you had, I don't know what your pitch would have been at the time, but it felt like we're going to talk to the public. It sounds ridiculous for an ad agency, but it felt like very real, visceral things. Sod Soho, the ad industry. We're going to do these populist big things.
Yeah.
And then presumably they one attracts the other once you start talking in that way. Yeah, I mean, so they really hit big. So how did you? I remember when we came in, me and Paul once to do something with it. You had Duncan Jones there, which is weird. You've seen David Bowie when he pointed at you back then.
Yeah,
and then I remember seeing him thinking, God, he looks and surprisingly
Zoe.
Like.
And I'd grown up with
Zoe,
Zoe.
Who obviously Zoe. We would have been aware.
Yeah, little Zoe
with his long hair. And, and I remember you said, oh, it's weird. He's done this. He's done a curse. Funny, these little things you retain. He's done a, over the weekend, he did a
he shot a Heinz commercial.
And sort of.
In his back garden.
Did paint box or whatever it would have been at the time.
Yeah.
Over the weekend.
Yeah.
And that was quite a long time ago.
And it ran.
And did it run?
Yeah.
Yeah. Presumably that obviously then leads to you producing Moon.
Yeah. And that changed everything. And that was the end of that.
So how did he.
That was the end of advertising really for me.
Yeah. So how did that. It's funny the Bowie link that goes through, but so how did he end up working for you? How did you find him or he find you?
A mate of mine who's no longer with us, Terry Werdingham, a TV producer, said to me one day, I want you to see a showreel. Show me the showreel. He said, what do you think of it? I said, I really like it. There's no ads on it, it's sort of short films. I said, I love it. And he said, would you like to meet this fella? I thought, well, yeah. And we went out to lunch, me and Terry, and Duncan turned up. It was Duncan. And Terry had done the right thing. He wanted to judge the work and not the man, you see. So he asked me at length what I thought of the reel and then said, OK, would you meet him? And then I met him. It was a lovely thing to do.
Did you know who he was when he turned up?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I knew he was in town, you know, and it blew my mind. And I got to know Duncan and I hired him. Just to have ideas, you know, just to come into the shop and just have ideas. And that's what he did.
So I've got to ask, did you ever meet his dad?
Yeah.
Did you really?
Well, what happened was Duncan would phone David every day and Duncan would sit in front of me. And again, it would blow that's my crazy. Mind that I know that Duncan is now talking to David in New York, you know, every day on the phone. And then when we did Moon, we launched Moon at Sundance, which is one of the weirdest places I've ever been in my life. That is like David Lynch's living room. It's so weird, that place. So we go there and we're going to screen Moon and we're in this kind of school gymnasium place where they put a screen up. It's so weird. And in the basement is like the green room before we go out and present Moon. And we'd heard a rumour that David was in town. Stuart, the producer, said to me, you know, we've heard that David's coming tonight out of the blue. He's out here skiing and he's going to come tonight. And I'm in the green room and Duncan says to me, come and say hello to me, Dad. And David walks in. And there's a photograph that I'll send you that I'm not in of Duncan and David. And I am just out of the frame. And it was taken 30 seconds later, you know, with the Sundance logos behind it. Yeah. And I'm there, you know, 2 inches out of the frame. And to this day, I've got no idea what I said to David. And I must have spoken to him for 5 minutes.
Really?
I've got no idea what I said to him. And then we went in to the screening and I sat behind David and Imam and we watched the film. And Duncan did his piece, you know.
So you didn't, ask Duncan, obviously you can't say, can I meet your dad? Which you obviously didn't. It just came about
naturally. We used to, we would talk about
David.
It's
an awkward thing, isn't it?
We would talk about David And he said, I took the whole agency to Vegas once, and me and Duncan got very drunk, and we talked about David.
I'd be thinking every day, could I be his dad? how do you get involved in Moon? Because obviously, presumably, you didn't know much about producing a film. Nor did he.
I'd been involved in first film I was involved in was Lockstock, because Stephen Marks. Yeah, because Stephen Marks exec produced it. Stephen Marks funded that, and Stephen Marks is FCUK. So, So I got involved in Lockstock, and then I did the ad campaign for Matthew Vaughan's first film, which was Layer Cake.
Right.
So I did the posters for that.
Oh, I didn't know you'd done that.
So I sort of got a bit involved, but with Moon it was full on, you know. It was everything, and it was lovely, you know. It was an emotional experience. It really was, and it's grown over the years as well.
Yeah.
You know, it's become this cult
thing.
Cult
film now.
It was a very special time, and you know, we went to the BAFTAs, and the first award up, Duncan wins the BAFTA, and that was it. Then that night, I just thought, I'm going to make movies now.
So stop with advertising.
Yeah.
So, is there anything that you learnt in advertising that you carry through to films?
Yeah.
What?
Urgency. The sense of urgency. Advertising has an incredible sense of urgency and getting things done. And movies move at glacial speed. And if you bring even an ounce of that urgency from Adland into movie land, you don't have to get stuff done.
Which is what exactly? That you can pull in, you can work with type music and pull in things and create stuff quickly.
You can create trailers, but you can write stuff, you can get things made quickly, and they're not in a hurry. They're just not in a hurry. And so it gives you an advantage to get stuff made quickly and get better prepared.
So that's like, do you know Peter Suter?
Yeah, I know well, yeah.
So Peter said that when he sold his first, I think it was either radio series or TV series, that he did it like a pitch. So he did introduce all the characters and they didn't know what the hell was happening because people don't do
that's
that.
Exactly
they
read out
same
the
thing,
television.
So he had all the boards is him and this is his backstory and this is this one. And
it's the same with TV. When I've worked with TV programming, you do the same thing and they don't pitch. In TV, it's really funny. They'll have an idea and if they get the feeling that the person behind the idea doesn't quite like it, they'll just drop it. It really is Alan Partridge. Like, well, I have another idea then. You know, it's... Yeah. I think that the professionalism of advertising as well. People are so professional, you know, they're so dedicated to what they do. You bring any of that combination of that can-do attitude and urgency and professionalism and pitching and belief in what you do. You sell the because you have to sell the movie to investors and to distributors. Then that's what we do, you know. So you're selling the package.
So what do you want to do over the next, however, 10 years, say? Make as many.
Yeah, I'm making
as many
five
films as
now.
You can. You're making five films.
Yeah.
So can you talk about any of those?
Yeah.
What
of course. Yeah. the big project I'm working on now is the life story of Brian Epstein, who's the man who discovered the Beatles, the fifth Beatle.
And is that something? What you found a script that you liked and invested in?
We're writing the script now.
You're writing it. Are you involved in?
Yeah, I'm involved in that. Yeah.
Really.
But the whole team of people involved in that and. And it's just going really well. It's really exciting. It's not a documentary. It's a, you know, it's a feature drama. Last year, we finished, because we've been working on it for 3 years, the feature documentary on the story of the Spitfire.
Yeah.
And the men and the women in particular who flew it, made it and flew it. We did the life story of Rudolf Nureyev last year, which has gone really well. And I did a film with Eddie Izzard and Judy Dench called 6 Minutes to Midnight, for like a wartime romp. That's going to be out early next year. I'm doing a feature drama on the life story of Sonny Liston, the boxer.
Right. Why Sonny Liston? Because obviously I know you're a big Ali.
Yeah, because it's called The Murder of Sonny Liston. So it's all about...
Was he murdered by
Well,
gangsters?
That's the question.
Yeah, right.
You know, it's the mob. It's all about the mob. It's a fascinating story. It's never been told properly, so that's a great one. We've just finished Archive, which is Moon 2, if you like, follow-up to Moon, in a way.
With Duncan Jones?
No, directed by Gav Rothery. And Gav did all the special effects, the video effects on Moon, and designed all the Interiors and the Look of Moon. He's written and directed that, and that's fantastic. That'll be out early next year. How many does that take me to? So all of that's all going on at the same time, all at different levels of finish, you know.
Yeah. Interestingly, this cultural theme is obviously that's really dealing in culture. All of those. It's like Nureyev, Sonny Liston. I mean, in fact, now you think of it, they're all, most of them are based on bits of culture, aren't they? They're not like a made-up story about, you know, something like
that's true,
coming from culture, which I hadn't really thought.
That's true.
So you've got Epstein.
Drawn me to it,
Spitfire.
Yeah. Nureyev.
Nureyev. And it's interesting, when I was kind of, I think we said this at the beginning, when I was researching it, it was difficult to get a hand on it, because you had all these, I kept finding pictures of you with different famous people. So Ali.
Yeah.
Which
there's no picture
is ridiculous.
Of me and, no picture of me and Bowie, though. But
there's no picture of you, but maybe you've got a shoulder or
something. But no, I met Ali 6 or 7 times. Yeah.
So you've bought with him. You've put on an exhibition of his stuff.
I've got the biggest
bought.
Ali collection in
Have
the world.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Why did you do that? Why did you start buying Ali stuff?
Because he's my hero. I've always connected
from
Ali.
From what
stuff.
Age did you?
From.
Well, what been, would that have been?
Ali's been my hero since I was 10.
Since you were 10?
You know.
So that was from the days when he was not as popular as he obviously is now.
Absolutely.
So he was, I can remember my granddad talking about.
People hated Ali.
Well,
they hated
being
Cassius
knocked
Clay.
Out by Richard Dunn.
He put him down 7 times. Yeah, he knocked Richard Dunn down 7 times, yeah.
He thought Richard Dunn, because a lot of people in those early days hated Ali. For
absolutely
the,
they did.
Obviously there was a Vietnam thing, the Henry Cooper, there was a, he cheated with him, there was a whole bunch of reasons.
Well, I own that glove, I own the split glove.
You own the split glove?
Yeah, that's the centrepiece of my collection.
But supposedly they...
The split glove, yeah. Yeah, I own
They
them.
Deliberately...
I worked with so Mandela, you, so on, Mandela you, on UNICEF. Yeah.
How did you meet Ali then? How did that come about? I'm equally, I've got a massive, I got the comic, which is such a weird thing, it's the only... Which is Ali against Superman.
Yes, God, that's a valuable piece. Bloody hell, that's a valuable piece. You're kidding me.
And I scanned in the thing and blew it up, so it's like a poster.
That was in our exhibition.
Was it?
Yeah.
Oh, that's
I haven't got that. I've got a print of that.
Have you really?
I haven't got the mag.
What a weird thing. Muhammad Ali versus Superman.
Black Superman, that's what he was, yeah.
But it's interesting, all these, you know, as I say, there's a lot of this sort of iconography and cultural stuff that goes from Ali, obviously Prince... Labour, we haven't begun to cover, which is often you're referred to as Labour's ad man. how did you get involved with Labour? Was that the back of FCUK?
Centuries before that.
Was it really?
Centuries. Ed Barker.
What, Labour?
God, yeah, I was part of New Labour. I was part of, there was, my God, way before that. It was... Deborah Mattinson, Philip Gould, bless him.
Peter Edwards, Barker.
Yeah, it was that time, round about then.
Jeez,
so it was Peter Mandelson, Deborah Mattinson, Philip Gould, Kinnock. It was that crew. That's when I started Labour. Started working on Labour. It went from there right through to Miliband.
Oh, I didn't realise you'd been doing it that long.
Yeah.
And that would have been at BNP as well, when you, obviously there for a little bit, but... Didn't they have the shadow, what was it called, the shadow...
Shadow Communication Agency. Yeah, well, I set that up with Deborah and Peter Mandelson, yeah. It's in need of setting up again right now.
Yeah, and then obviously, more recently I've read about the Jack and Ada Foundation.
Most important thing I've ever done in my life.
So tell me about that.
The foundation's the most important thing I've ever done in my life.
So what is the genesis of that? So it's named after your mum and dad.
Mm-hmm.
What was the idea behind that? Why do that?
Because when you lose your parents, it doesn't matter how old you are, you become an orphan, and it has a fundamental effect on you. However late life it is, when they're both gone, you're an orphan, and given that there was such a driving force through my childhood in particular, it was a chance to keep them alive, actually. And they had really strong values. And I didn't know the difference between a charity and a foundation, a charitable foundation, you know, and I do now. And it enables us to do some good when it's needed more than ever, you know. So we've done things like we take the Normandy veterans back to France every year, D-Day. We've helped out.
Is that part of the Jacinda Foundation?
Yeah. And we help out RNLI. We went to, in 2012, we helped set up some, not set up, but help fund food banks. And I'd never heard of a food bank. This is 2012. And there were two food banks in Birmingham in 2012. And now we've just become accustomed to this abomination. But it was a brand new thing, and it really intrigued and worried me at the same time, you know. And then most recently, our new initiative is Bank of Mum and Dad, which directly comes out of... It's an initiative. It's not instead of the foundation. It's an initiative of the foundation in the way that the D-Day thing was. And this is free loans for people. It's the antidote to Wonga. It's the antidote to the payday loan. 1,500% APR bullshit, you know. So we give loans of up to £1,000 to people. In short-term need of it. There's no fee, there's no interest rate, there's no charge. And the sooner they pay it back, the sooner it gets recycled and helps someone else out. And it's working, it's already happening. We've had five paid back already.
Have you really?
Within a few months they've paid back. And one woman has overpaid on purpose to give a contribution.
Amazing.
So it'll become a cycle of money in. So, you know, I ask for people if they want to sponsor a loan or put money in at that end, and then it comes out at this end and it goes back in again. Because there's a dignity in paying back your debt.
So where does that idea come from to do that? Again, that's like a very... Obviously, it's an incredibly unusual thing to think of and do and put your money where you're... You know, it's...
Why would you not do it?
Well, most people don't. I don't know. So...
Well, it comes out of watching I, Daniel Blake. Yeah. It comes out of watching the travesty of Universal Credit. It comes out of the impotency of opposition, you know. Being right doesn't feed people. Being right is okay. I'd rather be in government than in opposition. You get things done. And so, because I can't, then I, because we are not in government, then I will take it upon myself to do it, you know. So I've put 30,000-40,000 quid in to start, and that all just, that becomes loans, and then that just feeds in and out and in and out.
Yeah.
You know, and as the money comes back, it goes on to the next person. And it's about dignity. People, in the short term, you help them out because you allay their debt. But then in the medium term, they think, I can now pay this back. So they have the reward that they're doing the right thing. And then ultimately... the satisfaction of saying that they're then going to pass it on. They can choose who their loan money goes to next. Pass it
the
forward next.
The person who borrowed it can.
Yeah, we can say here are four cases.
And you get them involved in choosing who.
Yeah, you can come back. You can say, well, I think they're closest to the situation I was in. I'd like to help them out. And then later this year, we're going to have a dinner, a gathering where some of these guys can come up and say a few words about. How it helped them and how they helped other people, you know. So it's a pass it forward thing. It's a recyclable loan, but it's free, you know. It's the obscenity of 5,000% APR as it was. You know, Wonga came to the agency once and wanted us to pitch for their business.
Did they?
Yeah. We didn't. You know, it's shark infested, you know. It's someone said to me recently that there's a famous phrase which is it's expensive to be poor.
Yeah.
You know, because these payday loan companies, they'll say, well, if you pay it straight back next week, what's your problem? low interest, and just pay straight back. They don't want you to pay straight back. Then you don't pay straight back, and here's another loan to help pay that back, and here's another loan. And they're getting closer and closer to having your house, which is what they want. And it's sharking, you know, and it's getting worse and worse. And I just want to cut through that. And we've had an amazing response. I did a launch last week. We've had a soft launch of it because we need to get it exactly right. And we went public with it last week. We've had an amazing reaction from people. It's been really moving, actually. And some of the emails I've got through from people have been breathtaking, really. And we're just helping out who we can, you know. And it's working.
So you sort of ended up in such a diverse place. And obviously you go into space.
And I'm going to space.
Which is ludicrous, as we discussed. But what's the sort of the least crass way of saying it? But it's sort of interesting how all these, I can't think whether it's dreams, but of going to space, meeting David Bowie, meeting Muhammad Ali, owning some of his... It's like a load of things that seem not possible.
It is nonsense. It is nonsense when you put it like that, yeah.
And helping out people in trouble.
Mm. That's not nonsense.
That's not nonsense, but they're sort of notions that you've managed to realise somehow.
Mm. Well, I've only ever had one ambition, that is to go to space, so all the other stuff just comes in its wake, really.
I wonder whether that will change you going to space.
It's changed everyone else who's been there.
So when is that? When does that happen?
We haven't got a date. It'll be next year. There isn't a date yet. We'll get a several-month warning before we go, you know, advance notice.
And how many will go in your party?
Four. Four.
Do you know, presumably you must meet the four? And
Well, I know the group they'll come from. Together. Yeah, I know the group they'll come from.
And how will that be? Will that be, I don't know what the terms are, is that presumably professional space people? And then, I don't know, how does it, you know, what do you, what is it, four visits? How does it, what do you do? I've got no idea how you go to space. I'm just a regular Joe with no space experience. So someone must drive the thing, someone must do things.
Yes, a bloke called Dave Mackay, Scottish fellow. He was the first Scotsman in space last year. He test flew it to space. He'll be driving the thing. He'll be driving the thing. He'll have a co-pilot, and then there's four Herberts in the back.
And then there's four spectators, whatever you would call
them. Flaughty people. We'll flaught around.
So you don't have to learn to... do anything.
We don't have to drive the craft,
That was
basically no, we're not driving, we're just floating.
So, as a sort of going out question, getting it back to advertising, after all the interesting stuff about Ali and space, and, how do you feel about where it is today? Do you take much notice of it? Do you have a view
on
it?
I do. I think it's in a healthier position than it probably was 2 years ago. I think there's some exciting work coming through at the minute. And it's all about the work. It has worried itself sick about hiring the right people.
Yeah, seems so indulgent.
And I'm just bored with all that now, and I just want to talk about the work. And some good work coming through. So I'm more optimistic now about the business than I was a few years ago.
It feels like it's changing.
Yeah, I like what it is at the minute. I think it's quite lively, you know. It's interesting what's happening now. It's settled a bit.
So if there's some young kid from Birmingham listening to this who wants to get into advertising, what advice would you give them?
Do it. Do it, because less of you are. You know, there's fewer and fewer young people choosing advertising because it's a less funkier profession than it used to be. You know, they'd rather work at Google. You know, you can join it and then create it in your own, to your own vision, really. It is what you want it to be. That's what's so precious about it as a profession. You know, it's enabled me to meet my heroes and go to space, for God's sake. You know, I can't think of any other job that would enable me to do that. It because it touches so many different areas. If you just go into design, I think you're only going to meet designers. You know, if you go into advertising, you're going to meet everyone and every walk of life and it touches every creative point on the map.
Yeah.
And so therefore you can go into it and decide then which aspect of it. You know, I've come out wanting to do film, but I could have come out wanting to do anything from sculpture to car design, doesn't matter, to acting, to script writing, to anything.
Because you meet such a bunch of diverse people.
Yes, because they all eventually coagulate around advertising at some point. So, you know, if your hero is Ed Sheeran, God help you. But if your hero is Ed Sheeran, work in advertising, you'll meet him within a year.
Yeah.
I guarantee it. You'll meet him within a year. No big deal, but you will.
Yeah.
And that's extraordinary. If you've got a joke that you always wanted the public to know, it's your favourite joke.
Yeah.
Join advertising and 10 million people at some point will see that joke. Fantastic. You can't do that if you work at Ford, you know. But you can if you're Ford's advertiser. You know.
We're going to go out on that optimistic note. It can't be more optimistic than that. All right. Thanks for your time.
Cheers, fella.
Excellent. Thank you.
Nice one.